Hey, this is Jay Young with King Operating. Have you ever considered paying less money in taxes? Would you like to do what the wealthy do and invest in oil and gas? Go on our website, kingoperating.com, and get my book about our model, ADD, Acquire, Develop, and Divest, or call our number 214-420-3000 to talk to somebody today about investing in oil and gas and saving money on your taxes.
The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
What a great day it is here at the studios, and we've got some special guests for you today, but before we do any of the introductions, I think it's most important to thank our veterans on Veterans Day for what they've done for this country. It's an incredible task. I had a friend of mine in Afghanistan serving out there, flew a flag on my birthday, 9/11, and can't tell you how prideful I was to have received that. So special thanks to all our veterans. Today we're going to be talking about a variety of topics, and some of those topics are going to include the oil and gas market, certain sectors of the economy, but overall, what can we expect going forward as this election seems to go on forever? I want to start with Jay, if we can introduce you first while we're waiting on our guest. Jay Young comes to us here from Dallas. He runs King Operating. He's the CEO. He's run that company since 1996. His family has 100 years of history in the oil and gas business. His company has a different approach to the oil and gas business. Jay, acquire, develop, and divest. So why don't you introduce yourself a little bit more?
Okay. Well, thanks. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate that. You know, in our company, for the first 20 years, all we did was put together a couple of drilling projects and then just go drill them, and then that's pretty much it, right? I mean, we didn't think there was anything different. We just thought, well, hey, you put together a project, you drill it, and then 5 years ago, I was on a chairlift with a friend of mine, David Moore, Nightvest in the apartment business. They manage 20,000 plus doors a day now, but back then he was like, I said, man, how's business? And he goes, it's unbelievable. He goes, I got more people backed up, ready to invest, and I do apartments. I'm like, man, I got the other problem. I got product, and I don't have any investors because, oil and gas is cyclical, along with the stock market. So I was like, man, how do you do it? What do you do? How have you done it in the past, And he said, well, basically, we find an undervalued asset. We buy it. We put money into it, equity. And he said, then we'll either refinance it, keep it, or we'll sell it. And I thought, wow. So you buy an apartment complex for $8 million. You put $2 million of equity in it. You paint the sidewalks. You renovate it, put new roofs on, make it pretty, increase the rents. He goes, yeah. And I go, man, we could do that in oil and gas. So in 2015, we did that. We did exactly that. We increased the value of an asset. And a year later, clients got their money back in 2016. So real quick, I've got a client that put in $600,000 in 2015. They got a $500,000 write-off in 2015, saving $200,000 on their taxes. Wow. And then 2016, we gave them their money back, plus 30%, like $800,000. And then they still owns a piece of a bigger pie, So looks like he'll make a 2 to 3 to 1 return on his equity, So we started revolutionizing that because not everybody does that. Big companies, this is what they do, right? If you look at a company, they're worth X number of dollars. They want to increase the value and sell. That's what we do. But we do it with equity from investors. So like right now we're raising money on a $15 million fund. We're going to increase the value of that $15 million. Oil prices go up, it's going to be worth 30, 40 million, maybe even 40, 50 million. Well, then we'll sell. It's pretty simple. When you hit cycles, and that's where we are right now, we are in a great, We're going to talk about this with John in just a minute. Mm-hmm. But that's where we were for the last couple of minutes. I got like 12 text messages. Where are you guys? Where are you guys? So we'll get there, but we'll talk about this with John in a little bit about where are the cycles? Is the stock market, is it overvalued? Where's real estate? You know, I'd love to have some conversations about real estate right now because, I mean, I don't know where the occupancy levels were, you know, on retail or, you know, with that. But, you know, when we do go back to work, who is going back to work?
Right. And
how
where?
How many people will, you know, go back to work? And right. How many people have found a way to work remotely, you know, so...
Well, if I heard you correctly, divest is what I heard in there. And that seems most important to try to take out some of the cycles.
You got to. Man, you got three things there. You drill to increase the value of an asset. Oil prices go up, like our building that I sold. You know, I bought it for $100 a square foot. Went to $170 a square foot. I sold it. Well, I didn't do anything. The price went up in the neighborhood, so I got an advantage.
All right.
Same thing with oil prices. Oil prices go up, you sell. Mm-hmm. We go from 40 to 60. Oh, it's worth a lot more money.
Right.
The third thing is that you have to make sure that you're in a, you have an asset that you have scalability and you have an exit.
Right.
And you do that. That's
excellent,
how you really
sir.
Quantify it, monetize it, quantify it.
Excellent. And the conversation is going to go that direction in just a little bit here. We're going to have John Malden join us. And just to start the introduction on John, he is a New York Times bestseller four times. And might I say, you've got a book out, The Upside of Oil and Gas Investing. And that's where you describe...
Nowhere close to John Malden's deal,
right.
Though, I tell you.
But that's where you describe what we just talked about in brief there. So, again, a New York Times bestseller four times, John Malden joins us today. He had started a newsletter years ago and for 30 years has been producing this. And he produces thoughts from the front line. It's a free newsletter. You can go to MaldenEconomics.com and register for it. And these newsletters come out. And let me tell you how timely they are. I've been looking through some of them. Eliminating federal debt, healthcare, how that could be the next great crisis when it comes to the economy. And the Great Reset is something that John talks about as well. But Thoughts from the Front Line is one of those things that can help you keep your pulse on, or keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the economy. John is out of Puerto Rico and has seven children. God bless you, sir. With that, I'll flip it to John Malden to introduce himself.
Well, I technically have eight children because my wife, Shane, has one. So
okay.
I have two black sons. Two Asian daughters. Her son is a, even though he's blonde haired and almost blue eyed, he has a Choctaw Indian card. And then I've got a redhead and a brunette. So there's eight of them. So Thanksgiving will be fun. We're going to do it back in Dallas at a VRBO because I've sold my home there. And I'm now officially living in Puerto Rico.
It's a beautiful place. Been there a few times.
It is wonderful living in paradise. If you've got to be stuck in quarantine, paradise, this is a good place to be in paradise.
Of course. Well, we started the show by thanking our veterans, and you know, they're still serving overseas, and so we appreciate them very much. But I wanted to dive in to several things. That, as a financial advisor, a licensed investment person, I'm looking at COVID-19 and the shutdown of the U.S. economy for the last year, and we seem to have a disconnect between what's going on in the financial markets and what we're seeing from a shutdown perspective. I'm sitting here watching traffic go by, but at the same time, you know, has the economy suffered from COVID-19 as much as we think, or what's going on now?
Well, it surely suffered a tremendous deal. I mean, we were down, what, 35%, 39%, I think. We're back up 33% on an annualized basis. But we're still 10% below where we were. That's still recession territory. We still have 18 million people that are on unemployment insurance of some kind. There's probably another 5 to 6 million minimum gig workers that aren't getting anything. this is it is particularly hitting lower income workers. You know, there's a company in Dallas that's got 125 hotels. They've laid off 6,000 people and probably going to lay off more. I mean, and these weren't high paid managers. I mean, though they lost some high paid managers too. But by and large, they were the maids, they were the front desk people, they were the bartenders. And that's what we're seeing across the country. Those with college degrees, their jobs are back to within 10% of where they were. Those without college degrees are still 20 to 30% off. It's particularly hit the working class, if you will. And 20% of small businesses are still shut down. You cannot have an economic recovery when 20% of your businesses are don't have their door open, because that means a lot of people aren't working. The businesses that service them are not getting as much business. I mean, it just trickles through the economy everywhere.
A note to take that a little bit further, as we look at consumer spending continuously throughout history being about 70% of GDP, when do we see that really affect the economy from that standpoint? We were seeing a whipsaw back and forth. Growth was down significantly and now up again. Do we see a calming of this volatility at all in the near future?
No, because part of the reason the growth came back was the first stimulus package. And we really put an enormous amount of money into the hands of people. Now we also put it into the states and other things that probably wasn't the best expenditure of money. But we did put money into the hands of unemployed people who were able to maintain their lifestyle. Nancy Pelosi made a very calculated bet that she wasn't going to give Donald Trump anything to go on, and that after the election, she'd have a Republican Senate and a Republican House, and you know, there would be a blue wave, and she'd be able to control it and make up for it. Well, that didn't turn out. That's why her Democratic caucus is extraordinarily angry at her, because the progressives and the moderates, if you will, and there are moderates within their Democratic Party, they're center left, but they're center left. They're not far left. And a lot of them lost. I mean, they're down 7 so far. The last count I saw, there's couple of races that are still too close to be called, but the Republicans are leading in. I mean, they could end up losing 10, maybe 12 seats if they recount. If the Supreme Court says recount Pennsylvania, throw out those 30,000, 40,000 votes, it's not going to do anything to help Trump. I don't see any path where Trump comes back and can become president. You look at the numbers, you look at what would be changed and so forth. But it could make a difference of 2 and possibly 3 Republican congressional members in Pennsylvania that are, in fact, just that close. And you throw out some of those votes, that's a big difference. I mean, you know, it's when you're down by 800 votes and, you know, there's 1,200 votes that came in late, they're mostly going to be Democrats. That could be a swing. She's got a, at best, 7-person. I mean, if 7 Democrats switch parties, there'd be a Republican a speaker. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's how close it is. So you get 3 more, 4 more. All of a sudden, Democrats in seats that Trump won and counties that Trump won are looking over their shoulder and going, what are we doing? I mean, you look at Joe Manchin in West Virginia. He will not run as a Democrat in 2024. He'll lose. He barely held on to his seat the last time. Trump took the West Virginia by 20 points. It would not surprise me to see Manchin shift parties at some point in the process. McConnell offers him a chairmanship of something. But he's already come out and said, I'm not going to vote for a Green New Deal. I'm not going to vote for, taxes and all these other things. So there's a lot of things that will change between now and 2022. Republicans picked up two more state legislatures. I mean, the Republican Party won this last election. We lost the White House. Trump lost. But we picked up two state legislatures. We picked up a lot of members in the House. We didn't lose. Well, assuming we get at least one or two of the Georgia races, we can talk about that and later if you want. We're not going to lose the Senate. That was a, considering how large the popular vote was differential. It could end up being, when they get all of votes counted, 6 to 7 million for Biden, which is a massive margin. And yet we didn't lose we gained seats in the House and we didn't lose the Senate. All those seats in the Senate that were supposed to be vulnerable turned out not to be. Without the Libertarian candidate, Perdue would have won in Georgia. All of those other candidates will not be on the ballot in the runoff. Loeffler was running against 13 people. Of course, she couldn't win. Now there won't, a small majority. It's not a lot, but a small majority of Republicans turning out, and they haven't had a Republican lose a runoff race, I've been told, since 92. Some of us are older. Jay, you're probably not old enough, but I can remember when you could get the entire Republican Party in a phone booth back in the late 70s. I mean, we were just ecstatic. Well, as we were ecstatic when we had our first state senator that came out of Fort Worth. The state slowly switched to being a Republican state over time. Less so today than it was 10 or 15 years ago, but still, that's where we are. Georgia was the same way. It was a very Democratic state, and all of a sudden it changed over time. And I'm sorry, a phone went off and it sidetracked me. But anyway, Georgia was a Democratic state. Mid to late 80s, 90s started becoming a Republican state. And so the runoffs, that's just a part of the peculiarities of the Georgia system. You can have lots of people running and then they take the two best and then they have runoffs. That happens. But Republicans haven't lost one of those. So this time we're going to see $1 billion, at least, half a billion is a guaranteed number. It wouldn't surprise me to see $1 billion go into that race. There won't be a billboard, an ad spot, anything left to be that's not going to be used. Huge social media budgets, knocking on doors.
Should we all move to Georgia? Should we get a bunch of us to move there temporarily?
It's too late to move to Georgia, and I don't have a opportunity to become a member of Augusta National. So, there's just no pull to be for Georgia. But if you've got friends in Georgia, you want to encourage. I'm assuming that we're on a Republican-friendly panel right now, our conversation.
Yeah.
But I will say this. I haven't made many political donations, even though I was heavily involved with the Republican Party in Texas on the state executive committee for 20 years. I haven't made many donations in the last 4 or 5 years. I made my first donation to a Georgia senator yesterday, and probably won't be the last time I do that. This is a critical vote, and the Georgia Democratic machine has a get out the vote campaign that is solid. Biden won the state narrowly, but he won. And it's not a foregone conclusion that if you don't work this just as hard as any campaign you've ever worked, that you won't see that kind of you could lose again. I mean, and a 50-50 House with Kamala Harris as vice president is the same as giving them the Senate. Then you're going to have to see, you're going to see your taxes go up. That's almost a guarantee. Corporate taxes are going to go up. You'll see a different type of regulatory climate. I don't think you'll see, based on what Manchin said, a Green New Deal, but you'll see other things, appointments that will be more progressive left. Biden, with a Republican Senate, can go to the progressive left. And he's a centrist, always has been. He's a deal doer. And that, by the way, that is not a criticism. Gingrich and Clinton were deal doers, and we ended up with a balanced budget and a surplus. So I'm not against compromising. And that's a good thing. And a split government can actually get you to a place that's much better for the country. But you have to have people willing to work across the aisles. And Biden has historically done that. If he has a Republican Senate, he could turn around to all the progressives and say, guys, you know, I'm handcuffed. We got to, you know, if we want to do things, we've got to work together and move things forward. If he has a Democrat Senate, then that means Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are controlling the agenda.
Got you. On that note, it has to do with that, and it brings into account oil and gas as well. I'm keeping my finger on the pulse of what's going on social media. And some people feel like they're being censored wherever they put out some messages. And I've seen some messages from truckers, a man with 178 trucks in his fleet threatening to shut down his fleet for a bit. And so that kind of volatility that we see will last for some time. But if we get a Biden presidency, if Trump doesn't have something up his sleeve on this, then that stalemate that you mentioned and the inability to change anything from a tax perspective, what does that mean for the economy next year? And if the truckers actually do this and they pull something off that might hurt this economy for the short term, you know, what should we expect, you know, from that volatility? You said it's not going to stop for a while. So what are we to do?
First of all, you have to realize Pfizer announced a vaccine yesterday with a 90% efficacy, which is huge because within the margin of error, that could be as much as 94 to 95%. I mean, when you understand the data, that's monster. I mean, that's the only other thing that's that effective was the measles vaccine, that we all had when we were kids. That's an amazing accomplishment. Now, it's got to be stored at like minus 70 degrees. It's got to be diluted when it gets there. It's got to be immediately given after you take it out of that cold storage. So there's a lot of logistic problems that are surrounding the Pfizer drug. So it's not going to, you know, show up and we all get our vaccines in January. It's a two-stage vaccine. It's, you know, got to take it day one and then day 21, and then it'll be day 31 to day 40 before you're actually immune. the hope is that it lasts for a year or two, and then you get a booster shot. But
sure,
you know, by April, May, June, that's not unrealistic. But 20% of the businesses, they're already gone. Now, there are entrepreneurs out there whose businesses went down. They're going to try to figure out how to get them back. They're going to have to go out and find money. There's going to be opportunities for investors to help these businesses. I mean, you've got proven business managers who ran a business that some of these, some businesses were in business for 20, 30, 40 years and had to shut down. Well, so you've got proven management that's just now going to need startup capital. There's going to be lots of opportunities to get involved in local businesses again, and I would encourage people to look for those. But that takes time. You've got to go back and get the facilities. You've got to get everything turned back on. You've got to get advertising ramped up. We're going to need to see another stimulus package. It's not going to be anywhere near what Pelosi wanted to had on the table, could have taken. She made a bad miscalculation from the standpoint of her caucus. I mean, they are very angry. They had $2 trillion on the table. They'll be lucky to get $1 trillion now. And it's mostly going to be for individual unemployment payments. That's good. That'll help boost the consumer spending that you were talking about, sir. And we might need a second round of that because it's going to take some time for the, for all of this to happen. It just doesn't happen overnight. Typically, after a recession, it's 46 months before you've recovered your unemployment and your GDP and everything going back. So, I mean, this isn't we're not through this in 2021. We're not going back to whatever we thought of as normal. And frankly, commercial real estate is going to be repriced. I mean, Jay, you've had to deal with oil being repriced because demand was down. Well, as the world economy comes back, as the vaccine gets put out there, the demand for oil is going to rise. I think it's fascinating that those wise people that run the Dow, you know, pick the 30 members of the Dow, they decided to kick out ExxonMobil and Pfizer at the very bottom of those stocks. And now Pfizer looks like it's the lead for the drug. I mean, there's going to be other vaccines, but vaccines with a 90% probability rate, efficacy rate, that's an amazing story. I mean, and you just, I mean, normally 50% is considered good for flu shots. So that's amazing. So,
Mr. Malden,
and I think when we're talking about energy, I would expect energy right now is probably a good buy. I mean, it's because we're just, the world's going to come back out of it. That's what entrepreneurs do. That's what businessmen do. I mean, the vaccine hit us from out of nowhere. And it's taken down supply. We're going to increase demand. And for a period of time, you're going to see the price of oil go back. I don't think we'll ever see $100 a barrel oil again. But, you know, 50, 60 is certainly within the realm of reason. And 50, 60, all of a sudden, Jay's happy, jumping up and down, wanting to go drill more holes.
You said that we could see an economic recovery somewhere in the later end
of 2022, 2023. I mean, we're going to be recovering all along that time, but it's not V-shaped. It's we've had this rocket ship. We've had a bunch of stimulus. We get some more stimulus. It'll go up some more, but then it's just going to flatten out, and we've got to see what the slope of the recovery looks like. Do we go back to the slope of growth, which wasn't all that good? It was about 2%. Well, that's a long time to go from down 10 to recovering 2% a year, 3% a year.
But as it occurs, you know, from Jay's perspective in oil and gas, and Jay, I'd love for you to weigh in on this, rig count is down historically right now. Pipelines have been shut down, and you've seen this before with your family having 100 years of experience in the business. What do you see for the demand based on a potential recovery here and COVID-19 response with the vaccine and the potential for more cars, more airplanes being in the air and all that?
Yeah, I think John's exactly right. And he's the supply and demand economist. You know, that's what he deals with more than I do. So I just understand it from a perspective of, okay, at one point, we need 22 million barrels a day in the United States, the continental United States. That's how much oil we need. We're producing 13. We've never been energy independent to where we're producing more oil than we're using. Okay. Now, maybe there's been that term thrown around by politicians because they want to take, you know, credit. Mm-hmm. And maybe we weren't buying oil from terrorists. Or maybe just Canada or Mexico, you know, something, but we've never been. So right now, we're at about 20 million. We need 20 million barrels of oil a day right now. Hey, demand's down, no question. COVID, people not driving, people not, you know, it's going down. But your supply is also, I mean, U.S. oil production, you know, look it up. I mean, it's 10 million barrels or less. So we needed 22, we were producing 13. Now we're at 20 million barrels a day we need. We're at 10. But the supply, from my thoughts, just from a base, shale wells that got us up to that big increase, decline 60% the first year, 60, 70% the first year.
This is shale, because you
this
got
is the shale.
The
yeah.
Texas accent sounds like shell. All right.
Shell.
Shale. All right.
S-H-A-L-L.
Right.
Not E-L-L.
Right.
Shell. Royal, no. But shell, S-H-A-L-E. Yeah. So that rock, it is so tight and it's so hard that when you do frack it, you know, you have to frack it. When you do frack it, it comes back together. When it does, it decreases in production. So you may have a well that starts out at 1,000 barrels a day or 2,000 barrels a day, but it's at 200-300 barrels a day by the end of the year just because of that decline you see. Well, okay, so all the wells that you have online are declining, 70% less rigs drilling for oil and gas. Wow, not putting anything on the market. So you're going to have a supply problem in the next 6 months, 12 months when our demand continues to go up after Corona and Pfizer, and I'm with John on 90%. Oh my gosh, that's obviously a game changer. And you owning stock in Pfizer would be advisable. But
Pfizer, you wanted to own stock in Pfizer a week ago.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So I mean, it's
buy stock in Pfizer and also an oil well. Now, if you can't buy right. a Pfizer, buy an oil well, right? But so you're seeing that. So what will happen is the demand will start going up, not quickly, you know, that you're going to see it, but it will go up. And when we're going to be looking for, because we're going to be looking for all that oil in the market, we're not going to have it. I mean, it's going to go, hey, well, where's all that oil? The Hudson, there was oil tankers in the Hudson River and all the offshore California, and they're not there anymore.
Well, and on that note, as far as shale oil goes, the price at parity for them to make any money on it is $40 a barrel. We just crossed that line just the other day. That doesn't bring it back online immediately, though, does it? Because, you know, if there is a Biden presidency, then we've got, you know, potential issues on fracking. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, how fast and how efficient can he be at non-fracking, you know, and maybe the offshore, and John may know more about this than I do, but maybe the offshore, you know, and all the different places. But, you know, I mean, don't forget, you don't just stop tomorrow,
right?
Quit fracking,
right?
And you put in electric cars in your garage. I mean, right. Tesla's got 300,000 cars with it. I mean, that's great, but it's not, you know, as many as we need.
No.
So you just don't flip a switch and put electric cars in instead of, you know. Plus, there's all these other demands that you have for oil. But sure. It will get there in 2030, 35. I feel like that oil, Kramer has been saying for a while, one of John's friends, you know, Kramer has been saying for a while that, hey, you know what? Oil is the next tobacco. You know, I agree with him when I'm 70, 80 years old, but not when I'm in my 50s.
Right.
Right? Well, I'm in my 50s, so I think that we're going to have another cycle or two. I mean, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Jay Young, John Malden, these great people. Just kidding, John. But these great people are thinking that we have another cycle or two in oil, and I feel the same way.
Sure. I mean, just watching the traffic go by here at the studio, I haven't seen as many Teslas as I see the other types of cars. John, on to other sectors of the economy, such as technology and healthcare. In going to MaldenEconomics.com to do some research and review, technology and healthcare seem to be a big focus for you and your group. You had a documentary out about artificial intelligence just yesterday.
Right.
That was fantastic. Thank you for that. But if you will, go down those two paths for us on technology and healthcare and how important they are. Because I know the underpinning of healthcare was that could cause some market turmoil potentially as far as the debts incurred and taking care of people that are aging.
Well, we're going to see, I think, a lot of really interesting new technologies coming out in healthcare. I mean, I think that by the end of the decade, maybe even the middle of this decade, cancer becomes a nuisance rather than a life threatener. There are some amazing research that's being done on diabetes and obesity that will be out by the middle of this decade. We're doing a whole series of events on artificial intelligence that we're, you know, thrilled about doing the events because it's a growth industry. Technology is real. I mean, the growth and that's where we're going to see a lot of growth. This is, you have to go back and look through you go back to the panic of 1873, you go forward. In the middle of every depression, in the middle of every recession, no matter what, the sweep of progress, the sweep of innovation, the sweep of technology has improved. That just doesn't slow down. And so we're actually seeing more patents. We're seeing more things happening. And from a healthcare perspective, I think it's fascinating. We've seen, you know, 100 different, I think it was 120 the last I saw, different groups trying to develop a vaccine for COVID. There's something like 60 in human trials right now. The interesting thing we're going to see is that there are so many new companies that were doing work on something besides vaccines. And the information on COVID came out. It says, here's the technology behind it. Here's what the DNA, the genome looks like. And some scientists at the company goes, well, our platform can do that. And so let's go do a COVID vaccine. And I think we're going to see in April, May, June, a second generation of vaccine with new vaccine platforms. Pfizer, AstraZeneca, all the ones that are coming out right now are platforms that we already know about. They were already there. They were the logical place to go. And that's where big pharma goes. You're going to see these new platforms come out with entirely novel approaches to creating vaccines, to treating disease. And some of them are going to be the basis for the next generation of vaccines. So that cooperation, whereas most companies try to keep their technology and their secrets together. The openness of this last effort, I think, was very, very encouraging. I'm hoping that continues on to a lot of other fields. You're seeing a lot more open source and technology. We're seeing amazing advances in batteries. IBM 2 days ago announced a new battery that doesn't use lithium, that is far denser in terms of its ability to hold electricity. So it uses half the size and weight. That would be a major game changer. And there's things like that just coming along almost every day. In one of my favorite companies that I'm looking at right now is in agriculture, and it's a private company, but they can teach a seed to evolve. And so rather than what other companies were doing, which was modifying, going in and putting a virus into a soybean or corn, so you have a genetically modified gene. These are genes that are being, the seeds are evolving. In the same way that if you go back and look at corn from 500 years ago or tomatoes from 500 years ago, it's a night and day difference. And that was because farmers would go, well, this is the best corn seed I've got. I'm going to plant this next year for my seed corn. And so it naturally evolved over time. Well, this company is able to do thousands of evolutions a week. And they're developing canola, corn, soybean, that are Europe, the United States, North America has already said this is not GMO. It's simply just evolution. They change a letter inside the genome. You're not replacing anything. You're not sticking a virus or anything like that. So it's non-genetically modified, but it has all of the benefits and much more than, say, what Monsanto was doing. And you can stack these evolutionary traits. I'll get my hand up here, but on top of each other, so that you can have corn that is herbicide resistant, it's fungus resistant, it has different kind of calories. You can make wheat that doesn't have gluten, it's gluten free. I mean, that's amazing. Now, they've been taken 15 years to build their platform. They're out starting to sell it. But that's going to revolutionize agriculture around the world. It's going to make us where we're using less herbicides, less fertilizer, which is good for the environment because it doesn't slip into our water stream. And it's going to make us more productive. And that's just one small area where things are getting better. I'm very optimistic about the future of humanity. I'm a little less and more skeptical and more pessimistic about the future of governments because we're building up massive amounts of debt. Sometime by the end of this year, certainly by the end of January, February, we're going to see $30 trillion of U.S. debt. By the mid-2025, we'll be at $40 trillion worth of debt, $50 trillion by the end of the decade. And that's using CBO projections. And that's assuming there's no more recessions this decade, which is a generous assumption. So it's very worrisome to me about how we're going to deal with all the debt, how we're going to deal with all these expenses. What are we the people as government going to do, and how are we going to get out of this crisis? At the same time, all these marvelous new technologies have come along and making our lives better. We're going to live a lot longer than we thought we were going to live. That's good news. You need to make sure that you work longer and save more money. Because you're going to live a lot longer and you're going to need more in your retirement portfolios.
And the push,
good news.
Well, the push with Social Security is to push it out a little bit further as well. I wanted to touch on something again, just to go back to it for a moment, is the COVID-19 effect on the economy and people coming back and jobs appearing. Goldman Sachs came out in a recent article and said that they see oil and gas at $65 a barrel by the end of next year. Does that calculate with you the same? Are you in that?
Well, ballpark? I mean, I don't really follow oil and gas to the extent where I'm pulling up spreadsheets and doing forecasting. Goldman Sachs does, other people do. But it certainly wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the numbers that Jay was talking about are well known. We are producing less. Demand is going to go up from where it is today because the economy is going to recover. It's just going to take a little bit longer. Well, it's going to take the same amount of time roughly that we came out of the last 2007-2008 recession. And it was 46 months on average after we came out of the 2001 recession. That's just what it is historically. So 3 years, 4 years. But during that time, demand is going to be increasing. And until enough operators can see some certainty that they say, okay, I want to get one of those rigs and I want to put a hole in the ground, then we're going to see the price of the supply of oil go down and the demand go up. And gee, what a shock, the price of oil will go up.
Well, and then on the note of all the optimism that you just shared with us about artificial intelligence and the technological advances that we should see in the very near future, and it's almost exponential, the growth rate of these charts, right, as far as that kind of stuff. Let's say that Joe Biden is able to get in there and things don't go the way that we think, and he is able to apply some of the tax changes, raising corporate taxes to 28% and personal taxes on the wealthy. I was looking at the numbers here, 43% on the top 0.1%, 37.4% on the top 99%. Those are the people that become the entrepreneurs, I believe. Let me know if that's the case or not, and the effect
on
the economy.
It's true. I mean, if they're able to get through that, and that boils down to the Georgia race. If we win the two races in Georgia, then Biden won't have that. Typically, the off elections, which for us will be 2022, but you go back to 2018, Democrats came in and took a majority. Same thing happened with Bush. Same thing happened with Obama in 2010. So you would expect, especially given how close it's going to be, that the Republicans will take the House in 2022. Biden's ability to do real damage. I mean, he can stop fracking on government lands. That's fine. That just makes the land that Jay's got and his fellow entrepreneurs that they've got access to more valuable. I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful that we'll win at least one, if not two, of those races in Georgia. And then the true damage to the economy. Now, you take corporate taxes back to 28%, that's going to reduce corporate profits. That's going to reduce their earnings. That's going to reduce their price in the shares. And that's going to create a bear market. So,
Unemployment also increases in unemployment as well, correct or no?
I think we've got two problems. Number one, we're going to see employment, especially post when we actually get a vaccine. You'll see entrepreneurs going, starting to come back. You're going to see a lot of small businesses come back. There's a new technology out called UVC is ultraviolet, and the C range under 222 nanometers. Columbia professor did this. He actually crowdfunded himself because he couldn't get any normal people to, you know, within his people to do it. And he found out that ultraviolet light under 222 nanometers will kill COVID or any virus or any bacteria, but it won't hurt the human body. We know that ultraviolets A and B will, of course, are dangerous and you don't want to get any of that. But in that smaller wavelength, it's not a problem. In fact, it's a benefit. And I talked to the head of the $40 billion private equity company yesterday that's funding it, because I'd helped them do some other things and we're friends. And he thinks that we'll have an LED. Right now they're using it a different way to produce it, but we'll have an LEDs within 2 to 3 years. Once you've got an LED, it's not an invisible spectrum. I mean, the light that's coming at me right now is an LED light that I've got shining out of my face. And it's cheap. I mean, it's just a lamp. It's cheap. You're going to see LED strips that will, in the non-visible light, that'll be at this 222 nanometers and down, that will kill all bacteria and viruses. So it's actually not just COVID. It's flus and colds and all sorts of stuff. And it's going to be on every table in every restaurant. It'll be, for a couple thousand dollars, you can have it in a bar. In the non-visible spectrum, so nobody even notices it. In stadiums, you'll have, Jay's big in the Ranger Stadium, but Jay, what you'll have is on the back of every chair in the Ranger Stadium, you're going to have a LED strip shooting out of this 222 nanometer thing that'll kill all the bacteria, in its range of, a few feet. But we'll be back to stadiums again. That is 3 to 4 years maximum out. And that's a huge impact because that's going to reduce the you're going to see it in elementary schools. I mean, I've got 8 kids. One kid would get sick and then it just go through the family. Well, pretty soon you're going to see families with the same LEDs and they're going to have it in all of the house. We're going to see a lot more healthy kids, a lot more healthy people getting fewer colds, fewer bacterial infections. I could go on for hours. New telecom technologies is coming up. I mean, so now when we see there's downsides, doctors and nurses are going to be less employed because they're not going to have less flus. The hospitals, as we get to automatic cars, we're going to need less drivers. And that's, it's not going to be every driver, but you're going to lose 500,000 jobs, 3 million, by the middle to, 26, 27, by the end of this decade, you lose maybe 2.5 to 3 million jobs. Those people have got to do something. They're going to have to, and driving a truck, driving a taxi doesn't necessarily train you. It's not an easily transferable skill. We're going to have a lot of new technologies that are going to impact employment. You're going to see more people working from home. Jay, you work from home a lot more than you used to. Where people are finding out they don't need quite the square footage in their offices they did. Everything's going to be repriced. I mean, this is going to be an amazing transformational period that we're coming into. It's going to be exciting, but it's going to be difficult. And we as a society are going to have to figure out how to make sure that everybody gets taken along on the good ride and the down rides as well.
And as far as this goes, the optimism and the economic recovery that's out there in the future, I've mentioned your website a couple of times. Jay Young has a website, kingoperating.com, to find out more about the project that he discussed a little bit ago. And I want to make sure, that people, if they want to check that out, they can go there and get Jay's opinion on oil and gas and his family history and all that. But you brought up something that was really interesting a second ago about the technology. Again, the technological advances in the LED lights. It made me think, what about China? Biden seems extremely friendly with China. And what kind of competition might we see if we...
I don't think there's skepticism across the aisle on dealing with China. It's going to be extremely difficult for China to disengage with us or for the U.S. to disengage with them. We just can't pull our manufacturing out. They can't pull. That's going to be a decade-long dance, and it'll be a difficult one. We're going to have to reduce our reliance upon China. They've demonstrated they're not the most reliable partners. That's just the way it is. Now, guys, I'm going to give you a couple more minutes because I've got to go to do another video. So give me your last couple questions and then we'll sign off. I hate to stop it. We're having fun, but.
No, that's great. And we really appreciate you being here. It's been an incredible experience to have you here as well. I know that you've got a hard stop coming up and I know that we can't disengage with China. Do you see the protective tariffs continuing to be in force with a potential Biden presidency?
That is a question that I don't know the answer. I was pretty aggressively against the tariffs to begin with. I always have been against tariffs. If Biden reduced the tariffs and changed it to where he was selective about which companies that he wanted to embargo, I would be much happier. I think the tariffs hurt America. I don't think they help us. So if Biden wanted to get rid of the tariffs, I would sit and applaud.
As it opens up the free flow, there's liquidity there. Money starts to flow again back and forth between the two countries. As far as liquidity goes, if we could broach some of the taxation and some of the changes that could take place recently, the SECURE Act, it forces people that are non-spousal beneficiaries of IRAs to take their assets out at a 10% clip per year. And that forces liquidity on the markets, but it also increases taxes for that individual. And if you're inheriting money at a certain period of your life, when your kids are going to college, the potential effect on the ability to get any kind of break for college expenses goes up too. So there's some unintended consequences that seem to be out there from a tax perspective. If raising taxes is something that they push on and are able to get, again, if you can give a percentage effect on the economic growth rate.
I think they're going to lose Georgia, at least Purdue, probably Loeffler. So I don't think they're going to be able to raise taxes. I mean, there's only so much they can do. They're going to have to deal with McConnell. Now, if McConnell gets a horse trade that he says, okay, I'll give you this little bit on taxes, but you're going to have to give me, X, Y, and Z, then it's a horse trade. That's what negotiations are about. Gingrich gave up a lot, but he got a lot. So I don't know how you, that's in the realm of speculation. And until you see what those negotiations look like,
Really, and out of respect for your time, I want to let you go. And I want to tell you again how much we appreciate you being here for the group.
Well, and I'm always happy to be with Jay.
Good deal.
Thanks, Sean. Great seeing you. Tell Shane I said hello. Y'all take care.
I will.
Pay that 4% tax down in Puerto Rico.
Well, I did notice it about tax time this just last year. I did move, was attracted to Puerto Rico because of the tax scenarios, and my businesses happen to fit. Not every business fits this particular model. But frankly, we found out that we should have moved here for the lifestyle. The taxes are good. We really have enjoyed living here. This is just a wonderful community. So, Jay, give my best to all you and yours, and maybe we'll see each other around Thanksgiving when I'm in Dallas.
Look forward to it, John. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank
you. Safe travels.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.